This is energizing.
I like this.
Don't you find this to be energizing? Hi, everybody. It's Bill F. It's Wendy Snyder. It's Monday. We're thrilled that you're listening. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. You can call us. You can text us. Do whatever you want. It's a free country.
It is a free country.
It's a free country.
For now, anyway.
As of this moment, the country is free. We'll see what happens later in the day, but for now, it's free.
I was thinking of you over the weekend.
Because why?
All this tennis excitement going on. I didn't watch a lick of it, but I kept getting alerts as to who won.
Yeah. It was very difficult to watch because of my hobbled state.
Leg injury.
To watch, I have a leg injury. When it was very hard to enjoy Wimbledon, and it was hard for one of the players to enjoy Wimbledon. The finals yesterday were very emotional. Did you see what happened?
No, I didn't. Please talk to me.
All right. So you got Roger Federer, who is one of the best tennis players in history. He, if not the best, he's just great. He just does not know how to lose.
I saw pictures of him never having seen him ever before. He's not what I expected him to look like.
How come?
He looks like a movie star or something.
He's handsome. He's very handsome.
In his own way.
And doesn't
sweat.
You've
never seen him before?
No. I really haven't. I looked at him and it was like, that's him?
Yeah.
I expected him to look more like Mickelson. The golfer.
Phil Mickelson?
Yeah. I don't know why. I just did.
That's odd. Well, he's got a lot of tennis guys have like this kind of they call it a lantern jaw.
Yes, you're right.
Very
Clutch Cargo like.
Yeah. A lot of your tennis players have that face.
They look like Clutch Cargo. Jimmy Connors kind of did.
A little bit. But Andy Murray has that face. Andy Roddick, who we talked to, has that face. Just there's no fat on them at all. Zero.
McEnroe does not have that face. He's got a baby face.
Yeah, right. His face, right. He's got a slightly different face, but they're all, they don't sweat. Roger Federer, when the game was over, he looked like he just got out of the shower. He was in
He had a sweatband on that absorbed all the sweat.
I guess.
You should wear that.
When I play, you know I just played. Like, you look at me and you go, did you play tennis for a few hours? Yes, you can tell by looking at me. These guys just look like they're hot off the press. So he played a guy who no one expected to get into the finals. It was just kind of fluky that he got into the finals at Wimbledon. And in the second set, with Roger Federer taking pretty good care of him, he was beating him pretty handily, he walked over to the line judge and whispered something. And then when that game was over, he sat on the side of the court and he just started crying.
Is he 12?
Nope. Because they were speculating as to why he was crying. And they said it's either an injury, because a lot of times if you go over and you say something to the line judge, it's, can you call a doctor over? Somebody has to take a look at something. But he didn't look at anything. He just kept talking to him. And Marin Cilic just kept crying. He was just on the side, just crying. And the guy was talking to him, and Cilic put a towel over his head, but we still knew he was in there, and he was crying, even with the towel on his head. And then he eventually got up, and the crowd went nuts. They loved the fact that he wasn't, because you pay a lot of money. You wait a long time, and you pay a lot of money to get into Wimbledon and see the finals.
You don't want to see him sitting on the sideline crying.
No, no. So he came back, and he was doing okay. Not great, but okay. And the crowd was really rallying behind him because, as John McEnroe said, this would be the greatest comeback of all time.
Everybody kind of wants the underdog to win.
Yeah.
So I can see where they'd rally.
There was and I have to say it was also not fair to Roger Federer because he's like waiting all through these.
The delay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's his game suffered a little bit, but it was a very one-sided match. And then when the match was over, Federer started crying. He just started crying. So I started crying. I'm like, well, everybody's crying. I should cry too.
What the hell happened to these tennis players?
It's very strange. I mean, I know how emotional a day like that can be. Although Federer, this is the eighth time he's won. So he's had that moment several times. This is the most anyone's ever won this thing.
Did the girls cry?
I didn't see any girls crying.
Huh.
A lot of celebrities there watching.
Were they crying?
No. No. The only ones crying were the guys playing. They were both, they had a little cry fest.
Was the newcomer just very overwhelmed? Is that what happened?
They still don't know.
Why doesn't somebody ask them?
Well, I think that would solve it. Because they started talking about having like a, they didn't use the phrase nervous breakdown, but panic attack was mentioned. They said, you know, it's happened in the past where somebody gets onto a big stage and you have like a panic attack. You go, oh man, there's a lot of pressure on me, and it all hits you at that moment.
But he had already played, correct?
They were three games into the second set.
Okay, the panic attack usually would happen prior to
beginning.
You even playing.
Yeah,
like
but
stage fright, you know.
I think this happened because he kind of realized it was not going anywhere near as well as he had hoped.
I think of the emotion going into it. If you're not supposed to be there,
right?
It's your big opportunity, and people are watching you. You probably put such pressure on yourself.
So yeah. Cry.
It's every morning when I start to work with you two. Like, what am I doing
set
here?
Set aside to weep.
Right.
I felt so bad for him. And the announcers kept saying, well, this is unprecedented. We've never seen anything like this. And nobody knew at that point if he was just going to walk off or, you know, if the crying would continue. And he kept getting mad. This is a guy who usually keeps his emotions in check, but he kept getting really mad at himself and saying stuff to himself. And at one point he took his racket and he hit the chair with it. And he's not like that usually. So he was having a bad day.
Hey, I get the pressure of finally being where you're supposed to be and maybe not expected to be there.
Right.
But, you know, show some sportsmanship and take it, you know, like a professional.
He still did. It's hard to explain because you didn't see it, but he still did. I mean, he was so when the match was over, there were kind words exchanged between both players. Nobody mentioned the fact that Federer was crying at the end.
Why was he crying?
Because he looks like Pete McMurray.
You are mean as hell on a Monday. It's Meanie Monday. And can I just say...
To Steve's defense, part of it might have been that.
I don't care when a guy cries. I really don't. It shows the sensitive side because I'm getting berated for berating someone for crying.
Yeah.
But it bothers me when athletes do it because I know it's emotional and I know it's something that means the world to you. But you know what? There's got to be a winner and a loser.
I think it boils down to the fact that at some point you realize... And it might be subliminal, and it might be more than that. But you say to yourself, I have devoted my life to this game, and I achieved winning Wimbledon is the biggest thing you can do in the game of tennis. So I think it hits you that all those hours weren't for naught, that there was a reason behind all that training and spending time training to look like Pete McMurray. So I think at some point you just say to yourself, it paid off. I worked hard to get here, and I got here, and I achieved what I set out to do. So I think maybe that plays a role in it.
Two texts said that he had a blister on his foot and knew he couldn't proceed. I saw on Sports News he had a huge blister on his foot also.
Yeah.
Blisters hurt. I get it.
And the timing on it couldn't be worse.
I know. And Michelle seems to know why Federer was crying. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. He was on the Today Show this morning, and he said he started to cry when he looked up in the stands and saw all his kids watching him. It was one of the first times where they could, be there with him to do it. Yeah. And Cilic probably was injured, as they said, with the blister.
Yeah.
And I think, you work that hard to get there, and then your body lets you down. I think that's just disappointing more than anything.
It is
hugely disappointing.
I get it.
And my wife said the same thing because she watched the end with me, and she said, for him to look up in the stands, he's got four kids. He's got twin daughters, and then a couple years later, he had twin sons, and they're all there. And he goes, my wife said, I think it was just looking over and saying, I did this with my kids watching. That
means so much more.
Yeah.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks,
you play
Michelle.
Tennis?
No, I do not, but I love to watch it, though.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Sure. Bye-bye.
But it was fun to watch, but it was so emotional for so many different reasons. But it was the most one-sided Wimbledon final I'd ever seen.
And how did this guy get, is it like a wild card? How did he make it to the...
just a strange matters of circumstance got him to the finals, but no one really expected him to get that high up. He's normally a very good player. Not yesterday, but more times than not, he's a very good player. A lot of pressure. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then there's a lot to discuss with you, so stay here. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. If you're just joining us, we're talking about yesterday as either Roger Federer or Pete McMurray was victorious at Wimbledon. We're not sure which one of them, but one of them was. I hope Pete's not listening.
He is.
What?
Huh? What did he text you?
He said that Thomas Sewell did a split screen of the two of them on Channel 9 this morning. I don't know if that's true. It must be true.
They look very similar. They have a very similar look to them. Wendy and I were just saying, Steve, because Wendy, you said, I don't like it when people cry at the end of a sporting event. If you're playing a game, stop crying at the end.
Listen, I understand you're overcome with emotion, and right. occasionally it does happen. I've seen little league kids that get angry, throw sure. their helmet and cry. And to me, it's like you're going to lose in life. You Absolutely. Can't cry every time you lose.
Now, I said to you, in all the times I've played sports over the years, I've never cried upon losing, but I have cried. When the Cubs won the World Series last fall, I cried. When the White Sox won in 2005, I cried. I have cried when the Blackhawks have won championships. And once when they lost in the semifinals, I cried. So it's really funny. As a participant, I've not cried, but as a viewer, as a fan, I have many times.
And I understand it. I just, you know, professionally, I know you're overcome with emotion, and sometimes you have to give in to your emotion,
sure.
and you should.
Sure.
It's not healthy not to. But I don't know what it is. I don't like it.
Don't you think, though, and I know you're a White Sox fan and not a Cubs fan, but you could apply this to 2005. Part of the emotional roller coaster is, like, when they win, like, in both times I thought, I might live my whole life and never see either of these teams win a World Series. So when it did finally happen, I couldn't control it. I'm like, this is ridiculous. I'm crying because a bunch of guys just won a championship. But in both cases, tears were just flowing. I couldn't stop.
And I get it. And Roger Federer looking up and seeing his family there, I almost understand that crying because
right.
that's just, you know, pride and everything coming
it's joy.
Together. It's yes. But it's pride, and it's a whole bunch of emotional
sure.
things. I don't know. I feel like I know this. I don't even know his name, the guy who got to the Wimbledon.
Aaron Cilic.
All right. You know, do what you got to do. But
right. It was
with a towel over his head?
Yeah. And I'm not sure if that was just, I mean, everyone knew he was crying at that point, so I don't think he was trying to hide it. I think he just needed to be in a separate place. You know, he just
yeah.
needed to kind of block everything out. So putting a towel over his head and just hanging his head low. But then I'm looking at Federer during this, and he's just walking around like.
It isn't fair that he, you know, he had no. a groove going.
Well, I wonder, and I don't know the answer to this, but if there's some rule that at some point he couldn't continue to stall. I mean, you can't. They told a story about years ago, a player who needed to talk to his psychiatrist who was in another country. So they let him place a phone call to some other country, and it took 25 minutes. And finally, the guy talked him into. He goes, "No, you got to keep playing." So
that
then
doesn't.
The guy went out.
That doesn't seem right.
Doesn't seem fair, does it?
And I understand people need their therapist sometimes, and that's fine. But to delay a game,
right.
it just you know.
Right.
There's a time for everything, and it wasn't this new guy's time.
No, not yesterday, but you know, maybe in the future, maybe. All right. So again, congratulations, Pete McMurray is your Wimbledon champion. Well-deserved. We'll take a quick break. We have a lot on today's show. Eric Zorn is coming on. We'll tell you about state fair foods, the strangest state fair foods of all time.
Fried butter.
Fried butter. I think it actually...
It's on the list.
Right. I was just going to say, there's something very, very close to
would
it.
Would you try it? I would.
Maybe.
I'm telling
possibly.
You, you could fry a Bic pen and I would eat it.
Bic pen on a stick. Fried
oh,
Bic pen on a stick is good. Bic on a stick. All right, we'll take a quick break. News is next and then more show. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Have you ever been to a state fair?
I got to be honest with you, no.
You've never been. I've never been to the Illinois State Fair, but I have been to the Florida State Fair. And
what have I been missing?
You know, it's hard for me to say because I was only there for, I spent one long day at the Florida State Fair.
As a kid or adult?
I was in college. I was dating a girl.
That was literally. Your spring break?
So
jeez.
Like you were a kidult.
I was a kidult. Thank you, Steve. That's the perfect word for it. I was dating a girl who lived in Florida, and she said the state fair was a big deal to her, and she wanted me to go, and I didn't want to go, but...
Was it over after that visit to the state
no,
fair?
No. Oh. No. But I knew at the time.
This is not the girl for me.
I would not attend many more state fairs. The people that were amazed by the chicken that plays tic-tac-toe was very alarming to me.
Dude, oh, I would be amazed by that.
I love state fairs.
Do you?
Absolutely.
You covered a bunch of them, didn't you?
I used to go to county fairs all the time. And you're talking about food at the fair, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's in the state fair in Springfield, I think they have a lot of places now, but you can get a meat parfait.
Yeah.
And that was my favorite thing.
I've heard of this. That's meat with ice cream in it, right?
No, it's like
it's
different.
It's just layered.
Oh, it is?
It's
I
different,
thought there was ice cream in there.
Different sorts of barbecued meat with a layer of mashed potatoes between each of them.
Oh.
Mm. Who's going to mix meat with ice cream?
I couldn't figure that out. But then I was baffled by how many people were watching the chicken win a tic-tac-toe. And they, like, I'm explaining to people.
Why do you ruin everything for everyone?
They were amazed. They're like, this chicken, he
it's
doesn't
still
lose.
Pretty
and
cool.
I go, well, you know what they do is inside the machine, they put feed by the square that they want the chicken to peck. I don't think so. I think this chicken is just good at tic-tac-toe. No, they throw a little grain down and the chicken goes, I don't think
what,
so.
What, did you have a megaphone and you were yelling right. at everybody?
This is fake.
It's a sham.
This is all a fake sham.
Bee wet blanket. I was at the Iowa State Fair a long time ago. They had the Obama butter, the butter Obama.
Yes, what? Shaped like
right.
a bust of him.
Yeah.
What higher honor is there for an American than to have your shape made out of butter? That's the highest honor you can have, I think. I don't know.
I'd rather have an action figure.
That would also be really cool.
Well, it got hot in there, and it turns out there was.
Right, right. Well, over at MSN, they have put together what they consider to be the all-time craziest state fair foods. Now, these...
I love these.
These are from all across America, various state fairs. I'll tell you the state, and then I'll tell you what their craziest food was. Let's start out in Texas, where you could get, if you were hungry enough, a deep-fried bacon cinnamon roll.
I'd try it.
I would definitely try that. You got bacon, you got cinnamon, it's fried.
You got deep fried.
It's healthy.
No.
The Texas State Fair is legendary for its commitment to clogging its patrons' arteries, it says here. And this deep fried cinnamon roll, which is covered in glaze and then topped with powdered sugar and plenty of crumbled bacon, certainly fits the bill. This was such a hit that it was the winner of the Big Tex Choice Awards.
Sounds good.
So you might have thought it was big, but did you realize it won the Big Tex
no,
Choice
I didn't.
Award? That says something, doesn't it?
But you got your bacon and you got cinnamon is everyone's best friend.
Yeah.
And it's good for you.
Yes, it's very healthy. In California, at the California State Fair, they used to serve the caveman turkey leg.
Did that at Taste of Chicago.
What's the difference between the caveman turkey leg and a traditional turkey leg? Do you know?
It
says, we have to
joke.
Admit, this one is pretty brilliant. Why eat a plain turkey leg when you can gnaw on one that's been wrapped in bacon and then deep fried? Do you see a theme starting to develop?
Yeah, but that would ruin it for me, quite honestly.
Because it would take away from the turkey taste?
It's too much.
Yeah.
Kev?
Did cavemen have deep fryers?
Yeah.
Oh.
Cavemen did, yeah.
They had a fry daddy.
Right.
And a fry baby.
Right.
They had them both.
Right. During the Mesozoic era, they developed those a long time ago. At the Ohio State Fair, you could get what they call deep-fried Buckeyes. I wonder what those are. Buckeyes are balls of peanut butter fudge, partially dipped in chocolate. Sorry.
Chocula. Count Chocula.
Yeah. Hey.
I know. That's
that
their idea.
Really good. That sounds really good. They're dipped in chocolate. They're a popular treat in Ohio and surrounding states. It makes perfect sense that someone thought to then batter them and fry them up at the Ohio State Fair. I have to be honest, that does sound pretty good to me.
I'd try it.
Yeah. At the New York State Fair, they have what they call the defibrillator. If you're going to create a dish called the defibrillator, you better make sure that it's the type of food that can clog your arteries just by looking at it. We think the one that was served up at Jim Hasbrook's Fried Specialties at New York State's Fair gets it right. Here's what it is. It consists of an Angus beef burger that is then topped in deep-fried bacon. Are you allowed to have food at a state fair that does not have bacon on it?
I guess not anymore.
That's like a national law. All right, so it's got deep-fried bacon. Then it has deep-fried pickles and some deep-fried cheese curds. On top of that, you get two grilled cheese sandwiches served as a bun. So a grilled cheese sandwich on each side of that, and that's the bun. It was introduced in 2015, and it says this gooey and greasy monstrosity has been estimated to contain more than 1,600 calories.
Good God.
That's a meal in itself, as people like to say.
I like all those things separately, but not together.
Not mountain together?
No. Like, I love a good grilled cheese, but I don't need that as a bun.
Right. That seems slightly excessive.
Fried cheese curds, almost the best thing ever invented. They're pretty great. But
would you agree, even though they're good, like, could you do them every day?
Yes.
Could you really?
Fried cheese curds?
Yeah, you could do them every day.
Culver's has really good ones.
That's right.
I mean, they really do.
They really do. They're very
good. Yeah, but
they're
good for, like, I think, Bill, 3/4 of an order.
That's about right, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I share them. I never have had a complete order.
No.
That's why I could eat them every day. You have two teenage boys. Like, whenever you get mozzarella sticks, you're lucky to get one when the appetizers arrive.
They dive right in?
Yeah.
Yeah. I could see that. At the North Carolina State Fair, they serve... Now, just by the name, this says... I got to try this. Miss Debbie's Specialty Apples. I don't know Miss Debbie, but when I hear that she has specialty apples, I get excited. Miss Debbie's Specialty Apples has a stand that's set up at the North Carolina State Fair, and these definitely aren't your grandma's candy apples. Just look at them. They're covered in chocolate and nuts and coconut, and yes, those are donuts on top. So
Come
it's
on.
An apple with a donut on top, but no sign of bacon. Why isn't there bacon on this? They're going to close this stand down.
Again, I hate this mixing and matching. Just if you want a donut, have a donut.
Right.
If you want an apple, have an apple.
But for some reason, I think if people assume, and I'll be honest with you, I've done this on vacation. Because you're on vacation, you say to yourself, well, these calories don't count. I can pound this. Doesn't matter. I'm on vacation. People do that at the state fair. At the Arizona State Fair, they have deep-fried pecan pie. It says pecan pie is well-established as basically the unhealthiest pie in existence. Its filling is just nuts and butter and corn syrup.
That's awesome.
So, of course, it makes sense to then batter and fry it.
I'd have that in a second.
Holds together better than any other pie.
Wouldn't it?
Right?
It would.
Doesn't break apart.
It would congeal.
Mm-hmm.
At the Arizona State Fair, the batter is so thick that you're basically eating a gooey pie-filled donut. Is that bad?
I'd have that.
I don't know if that's bad or good. At the Colorado State Fair, you can get the Mexican funnel cake. Funnel cake is a carnival and state fair staple and is even occasionally used as a hamburger bun.
No, it is
not. I don't think it is either. Is it? By who? But at the Colorado State Fair, they take it one step further. Instead of a traditional funnel cake batter, the mix is then dropped into the oil through a churro extruder. Two words I didn't think I'd ever see together, churro and extruder. The end result is essentially a several foot long churro.
See, churros taste very different than a funnel cake, and I much prefer the funnel cake. So you're just
remind me what the difference.
A funnel cake is just basically dough dropped in boiling oil, and you put powdered sugar on it. A churro is a long cylindrical thing.
Right.
Dipped in sugar and
it's a powdered sugar though, right?
No, that is more of a granule sugar. The powdered sugar is the funnel cake. A funnel cake is much lighter.
I guess
in consistency.
So. Do you know what? Whenever I think of either churros or funnel cakes, here's what it brings me back to, and I think you'll identify with this. At Old Comiskey Park.
Yep.
The way the park was situated, it was almost like different. Like if you did a complete circle under Old Comiskey Park, it was like going through different neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a part in the outfield that had incredible churros and funnel cakes. And I don't remember them being available. They must have been, but I don't remember seeing them in other stands around the park. But in like left center field, they had them and they were outstanding. They were so good.
They have them all over now.
They do?
Yeah.
Bill, I can see that stand right
now. Do you remember it?
Absolutely.
It was so good.
It was underneath.
So good.
It did smell good.
Oh, so good. I used to go there with Carlos May. He and I, after a game, would enjoy a funnel cake and a churro together. All right, let's take a quick break.
Oh, my God.
If you want to jump in, we're at 312-981-7200, talking about the strangest of state fair foods. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. It's Bill F. It's Wendy Snyder, and we're discussing some of the stranger state fair foods that have ever been consumed. Sue is on the line and has one that is interesting at best.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Sue.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, actually, I'm kind of grossed out because I wish this was a state fair food, and I have a feeling it probably is somewhere in the universe, but
yeah.
This was a WGN segment, I believe, It was over the weekend. It wasn't Walter Payton's cute daughter who does that show.
Brittany?
But, yeah.
Yeah.
It was, my husband and I were, you know, watching TV, like old people at night.
Yeah.
And although our 17-year-old son, we have a bunch of boys, and he was sitting there with us, and all of a sudden, there it was, barbecue ice cream. And, you know, my son's like, hey, cool, Mom. I'm like, no, not cool. It was like vanilla ice cream with chunks of meat in it.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know. That's exactly what I did. And I said to my husband, like, you know, sweet baby Ray's, like caramel would be like in an ice cream. And they had people try it. And so they were like, this is awesome. And I just thought, there's certain things that are sacred. And I don't think ice cream and barbecue meats.
That doesn't work at all.
Together.
Well, it's weird because Steve Bertrand and I teased Bill when he thought a meat parfait was meat and ice cream, but evidently Bill wasn't
I'm a visionary.
That's what I thought. I was just driving a 94, although I'm up in Gurnee, so we still have to reroute ourselves because of the
water. Oh, yeah, the flood.
It's like we go one way and we go another. And I heard you say that, and I'm like, please say it's not ice cream and beef because I was going to tell you about it. But I still wouldn't eat that. I just wanted to tell you that barbecue ice cream is in the world
now. It exists. How about that? Well, thank you, Sue. Have a great week.
You're welcome, guys.
Take care.
I love you. Okay.
Bye.
Love
Thanks,
you too.
Sue.
Yeah, I'm a huge ice cream fanatic, but you don't want to put meat in your ice cream.
Did you have ice cream on National Ice Cream Day yesterday?
Yes.
I did. You had to think about it for
a
moment. I
didn't know it was National Ice Cream Day, but yeah.
I even did.
Yeah, wow.
I know.
That's unusual for
you. It was soft serve in a waffle cone at Brookfield Zoo.
Oh.
But I celebrated with my great niece, Addie.
That still counts. At the State Fair in Texas, you can get, you hinted at this one earlier, and it does exist, and that would be fried butter.
I would totally try this. Butter's really good.
How much of it is a serving, though?
I think probably like a little pat of butter.
Yeah.
I think I heard Dean talking about this, and I think they take, on Sunday morning, they take a melon baller and make a little ball of butter, then bread it and fry it.
I'd probably try it. I don't know how many of them I could eat.
It's like chicken cordon bleu.
It is kind of
chicken Kiev, actually.
Or chicken Kiev,
one that squirts at you.
Yeah, with the butter in the
center.
Right, the food that fights back. this creation that arguably started in all of Texas spots. Wait, it earned Texas a spot on the list. It was introduced back in 2010, and many assumed that the concept of deep-fried butter was actually too ridiculous to be true, but it is a real thing. Balls of butter are mixed with cinnamon and sugar and then dunked in butter and deep-fried.
It's like a cinnamon roll, kind of.
Yeah, it would be. It definitely would be. At the Oklahoma State Fair, they have s'mores cinnamon rolls.
Mm.
That sounds good. This one is a mashup for the ages. It's a giant cinnamon roll brimming with chocolate and then crumbled graham crackers, topped off with a whole lot of marshmallows. Hard to say no to that.
Yeah.
At the Minnesota State Fair, they have sautéed alligator and fries.
Alligator's really good.
I'm seeing that more and more. And actually, now that I think about it, I tried it once.
It's pretty good.
It was all right.
It does taste similar to chicken. I know people say that, but it really kind of does. It's kind of the same consistency.
A little tougher than chicken.
A little bit. But it's not fishy at all.
No. It says, yes, it is real alligator. It's sautéed and served atop an alligator-shaped mound of fries. I don't know why they'd need to reincorporate the alligator shape. You're already eating alligator. Considering the fact that alligator is notoriously tough and chewy, it says at MSN.com, we can't vouch for its flavor. At the Texas State Fair, again, this is the third entry for Texas, they have chicken fried bacon.
What?
I don't know.
So it's breaded. Because chicken fried steak is basically a hamburger with fried chicken batter on it.
Yeah.
Ugh.
That could be the perfect food right there.
What, chicken fried steak?
Chicken fried bacon?
Oh.
Yeah.
Battered bacon? But it's a thick cut?
Yeah.
See, bacon doesn't need to be breaded, though, guys. It's so good on its own.
It holds up on its own.
No, but breading needs bacon.
It needs something,
It needs cheese.
You can't... maybe cheese.
I mean, the breading does, not
right.
the bacon.
The breading would.
Bacon's good on its own.
It says in Texas you get thick slices of bacon and then chicken fried treatment on top, getting coated in a thick crust before making its way into the deep fryer. At the Wisconsin State Fair, you can find the pulled pork donut sandwich.
That's cray cray. A pulled pork donut sandwich.
Something for everyone. Donut sandwiches are a State Fair staple. They've been filled here with some ridiculous things, which usually involve burgers, but we'll stick with pulled pork in ours. So they endorse the pulled pork donut sandwich. At the Minnesota State Fair, you can get fried fruit on a stick. Why just eat a piece of fruit when you can put it on a stick and then batter it and fry it, they ask.
Depends what kind of fruit it is, though.
What are you envisioning? I'm trying to think of what would work for me.
I don't think any fruit fried would be good. I mean, I love strawberries, but frying them would ruin it.
Strawberries would be interesting. For some reason, watermelons in my head and bananas in my head. You wouldn't do either of those?
Maybe a fried banana.
Yeah.
Because they do the plantains, which is similar.
Yeah, it is similar. Maybe a layer of chocolate in there in between. So you fry up the banana, and then in shish kebab style, you have a chunk of chocolate.
Yeah, I like where
then
you're going.
Back to the banana, and then just alternate. That would be right.
Maybe by next summer or spring, we should start our new business, Bill and Wendy's Fest Food.
Do you want to do that? I'll open that up with you. All right, so they said they have the answer for this in Minnesota. It's also selling deep-fried bacon-wrapped cheese-stuffed olives, which are also a big hit. And then one more. This is like a dream that I had once. A deep-fried peanut butter cup. They have that at the Minnesota State Fair.
I would try that.
If you're going to coat something in pancake batter and fry it, why wouldn't it be a Reese's peanut butter cup, it asks.
Have you ever had the fried Twinkie?
I've seen it and not had it.
I tried it. It's better than a real Twinkie because I'm not a big Twinkie fan.
Yeah.
And yet, you think about it, I must have brought a Twinkie every day in my lunch bag when I was in grade school.
Did you have them regularly when you were a kid?
I would trade them for fruit. I'm weird.
It's too many doctors saying that there's like the expiration date on Twinkies. Remember when Hostess was going out of business and then people were looking at the boxes and going, these will last for 7 years, you know? There's some expiration date way, way off in the future, which means there's preservatives in there that can't be that good for you.
But that's not just in Twinkies.
No,
it's in
a lot of
everything.
Stuff. It's in everything.
But I mean, like, at least a Ho-Ho was good. A Twinkie was kind of bland.
Right.
So when you deep fried it, it was better.
It would add a little to it.
But the peanut butter cup.
That sounds all right, doesn't it? That would be tempting.
Warm, chocolatey goodness.
Yeah. That one's tempting. All right, a quick break. Steve with the news and then more show. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Thank you, Steve. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. A lot of documentaries are out and about right now, and I seem to be eating them up. I love them. Saw the trailer for this documentary, Losing Sight of Shore. It is now streaming worldwide on Netflix, and the documentary filmmaker Sarah Moshman is with us right now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Saw the trailer for this. I was telling you off the air. It's basically a crew rowing across the Pacific from America to Australia.
Right.
Just physical strength. And I just, as I'm watching this, I was touched. I was moved. I was inspired. And then I realized I have absolutely no ambition to do anything.
How about that?
That's unfortunate.
I hope you're happy with yourself, Sarah. You made one you realize that you have no
opposite goal.
But no, this is just the trailer.
Okay.
And then I started thinking about it. And what is the tagline for the documentary?
The tagline of the film is "Everyone has a Pacific to cross." So the idea is it doesn't have to be a physical thing. I'm certainly not an athlete or a rower myself, but we all have goals we want to achieve in our lives, some big, some small, and hopefully the film will help you get through that.
Why were you drawn to this?
So I made another documentary, The Empowerment Project, and I promoted that film, including with the two of you.
Mm-hmm.
And in promoting that film, a blogger in the UK reached out to me in January 2015, and she said, I thought you might want to hear about these women. They're about to row the Pacific Ocean. And my first thought was similar, like, what? That's insane. I know nothing about rowing. This is so not for me. But after Skyping with Laura and Natalia, two of the women on the team, I was just blown away because it was clear from the start this was never about that. It was about the power of the human spirit and what we're all capable of when we push ourselves to the limit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what spoke to me about their story, even though I knew nothing about the journey, the experience. I'm never on the ocean, even though I live in California. I'm not really an ocean person, but something about the story really spoke to me, and I wanted to help them tell their story.
But pushing yourself, I mean, really, we all want to be a better person, maybe being a better mom, maybe being a better dad.
Sure.
You can do it in that respect as well.
Of course, absolutely. a Pacific can be defined in any way. That's just how we want people to relate to it. We don't want people to watch the film and think, oh, that's not me, I could never do that. We want them to be approachable characters, which they are.
Oh, they
They're not
are.
Professional athletes. They have not been rowing their entire lives. And that's important. That's why I was drawn to them as well. They're underdogs, really.
Totally.
Yeah.
So when this idea is presented to you, does that mean, because they're going to be rowing across the Pacific Ocean,
right,
and as the filmmaker, you say, well, then that means that I would also be in that boat rowing.
No, not at
no?
all. I never had a desire. Although now that it's done, I wish I had some role in the boat. I did get to be in the boat at the end of the movie.
Oh,
but
best timing.
It was
good. Very smart timing.
Yeah, for the sweet part. No, but I bought them cameras. I taught them how to use the cameras. So they had hard drives and microphones and everything they would need on the boat at sea in this 29-foot pink ocean rowing boat called Doris.
Yeah.
And so I was there every time they were on land. So they started in San Francisco. They had an emergency stop in Santa Barbara, Hawaii, Samoa, and then the big finish, spoiler alert, in Australia.
Huh.
So it was quite a challenge for me as the filmmaker to not know what they were filming. It's not like this was Big Brother style where they're rolling all the time and I'm watching a feed of it. None of that.
So you didn't see the footage until it was done.
Until they were on land.
Wow.
So I got to pick up the hard drives in Hawaii and just pray that there was anything on them at all, let alone decent footage to cut through. So it got better as time went on. And they really took to being storytellers, not only because they were probably bored on the boat at times, but they kind of used the camera as this like fifth member of the team and someone to talk to. They would address the camera as if it was me. And so I would send them questions. It was a very odd situation as a director. It was so much risk involved. But they really evolved as storytellers. And it was really beautiful to watch it unfold as they were vulnerable and scared and happy and excited.
It's not pretty.
Fearful.
It just looks pretty intense.
Yeah, the scenery is pretty.
Yeah.
So this process is very unlike what most filmmakers usually employ. What would you have done differently? Like, would you have said it would have been better for me to have been on the boat, or is this a more interesting story this way?
I think it's more interesting this way. I mean, sure, I have fantasies that I had been on the boat at some stretch, but I also would get on a boat when they were about 12 hours offshore, and I would go meet them at sea and find this tiny pink dot on the horizon. And it was such an adventure for me, even though I wasn't on the boat with them, but to follow them around the world was just so incredible. And Tony Humphries is their shore support. So he obviously would help me find them. And then we'd, you know, deploy a drone and get all kinds of aerial footage of them at sea.
Yeah.
So it was a huge adventure, a massive production for me to direct. And I really kind of proved to myself what I'm capable of as a filmmaker. And that only comes from pushing yourself, from crossing a Pacific, from like having a goal and not being sure if you can reach it and then, you know, reaching it. So it's been quite an adventure putting this all together.
Like,
you know, the marathon has been not right now, but for the past, I'd say 10 years has been the new challenge that everybody's jumped towards.
Yeah.
And just watching these women achieve what they've tried to do, it reminded me of someone who all of a sudden just says, you know, I want to start running a marathon, because it's not easy the first time you do it.
Of course. And there's a lot of training that goes into it, mental and physical. The Coxless Crew, as they're called, the women that rode the Pacific Ocean, they say it's like 90% of a mental challenge, if you can believe it. So they rode 24 hours a day, 2 hours on, 2 hours off. So 12 hours of the day, they're exerting themselves physically, but they still said it was a 90% mental challenge and that anyone could do it with the amount of training. Again, they're not professional athletes. Some of them had never rowed before. They didn't just get onto the boat cold. They did train, but these are not, you know, Olympic level athletes that we put on a pedestal. These are regular women that had a goal and trained and achieved their
goal. What's the main danger in doing something like this?
Ooh, capsizing was a big fear. Fortunately, Doris, their boat did not capsize. It's a very well-designed boat that was designed just for this journey. In fact, it's kind of even more safe than a rescue boat.
Really?
So they did a capsize drill prior to leaving, but fortunately, their boat never did capsize, even though they had, you know, four-story waves.
I know you need to see it. Losing Sight of Shore. There's a screening July 19th. So is that Wednesday?
Yes.
7 p.m. at the Davis Theater. Where's the Davis Theater?
It's on Lincoln, and the whole evening benefits Girls on the Run Chicago.
That's a great program.
It's going to be a great night, yeah.
LosingSightOfShore.com. I know you don't want to give too much of the story away, but are some single, some with families, some with kids?
Yeah.
What kind of?
Oh, sure. I mean, they're varied ages. They're between 25 and 40 years old, and they're all single, at least at the time of the journey. So there were no kids left behind or significant others, and perhaps that's why they were able to do it, but perhaps not. I think a lot of my work is focused around female empowerment, but I really made a special effort to not talk about that too much, honestly, in this film, because I didn't want to alienate the audience. I didn't want it to seem like the boat is pink, so this is a film for women.
Right.
I want everyone to be inspired by the story, which I think anyone can be. So
man
that
or
really
woman.
Wasn't a big part of it. Yeah, they happen to be women is kind of how I see it.
Well, I know we kind of just glossed over this quickly, but the aspect of none of them really had a significant other or somebody left behind, that's an interesting story in and of itself, isn't
it? Well, of course, they have their parents were extremely worried about them at all times, and they were there on land as well. So that's not to say they don't have family.
Right.
Just not a spouse or
husband, girlfriend, boyfriend.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but that's when all of a sudden, you know, once you have kids, it's like a great moment, but you also realize my life's on hold for 18 years. So that's the time to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is before you have a family, because I can't imagine how long this took them. And
nine months. It was
You'd
supposed
be
to take
away.
6 months. It took nine.
My husband, by the way, has just texted me and said, why don't you jump on one of these cruises for 9 months?
Sure.
I'll handle the kids.
Easy. Sarah Moshman is here. We're talking about Losing Sight of Shore. If you want to join in, 312-981-7200. More after this. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Well, Sarah Moshman is our guest, making a return visit to the show. She is a documentary filmmaker born and raised right here in Evanston and just completed a film called Losing Sight of Shore. You just shared a very interesting fact with Wendy and myself. I find this impossible to believe, but these ladies on the boat, well, you say it.
Okay, so
amazing.
During the second leg of the journey from Hawaii to Samoa, it was supposed to take 60 days. It ended up taking 97 days. So as a result, they were running out of food, et cetera. But in the middle of that part of the journey, they were actually closer to the International Space Station than they were to any other humans on Earth.
It seems impossible, doesn't it?
It's pretty insane. In this world of technology and fast information, and we're always around each other, to have that kind of isolation is pretty incredible.
Why did it take that many more days than were expected?
Yeah, so they ran into a part of the ocean, and bear with me, this is not my expertise, but called the doldrums.
Yeah.
And it's a part of the ocean where the currents were not in their favor. So they ended up going backwards at times. They would physically exert themselves the equivalent of 50 miles in a day, but actually go 10 miles in the wrong direction.
Oh, my God.
Because of the currents. That would happen to them a lot, actually. So they were constantly exerting themselves, rowing 24 hours a day, 2 hours on, 2 hours off, but not always in the right direction.
Is there a thought during this, Sarah, that they say to themselves, well,
that's their thought.
Those would be the words you would say out loud, right? You would say those words.
Oh, constantly.
But where you say, we can never get out of this. The harder we go, the further back we go.
Absolutely. But I think the bigger lesson is the only way home was through. They couldn't turn around and they couldn't even be rescued in a quick fashion. So even if they had wanted to give up or quit, which you just couldn't. The only way, you know, home was to keep going in a lot of ways. And I think that's a great metaphor for life. So.
Wow.
I was flooded with emotion, and this is just seeing the trailer, so I can't wait to see Losing Sight of Shore, the full documentary. But I felt anxiety. I was scared for them. I actually cried. I mean, I can't imagine these women pushing through on something where you said you can't give up. You can't just all of a sudden stop paddling and just lay in the boat and cry, which is what I would do.
Yeah, well, people often ask me, did they really get along the whole time? And they had to. I mean, it doesn't matter that they're four women. That really has nothing to do with it. It's that they needed each other to get through those tough moments. So you can't argue. Of course they argued, but they got over it very quickly because they only had each other to get through those moments of what are we doing here? How are we going to get through this? I just want to go home.
Once they're done with this, I guess there's several different routes you can take, and one is I'm never getting on a boat again.
Sure.
I mean, I'm sure some people go, I can't wait to do this again, but mostly you go, I've had it at the sea.
Yeah.
What is their thought about continuing in this sort of thing?
So they're all very adventurous people, so they're all still doing many different challenges. In fact, they just swam a 10K together, so they're still close.
And that's
still
way easier than what they just did.
But still way hard for a normal person. I don't think any of them are planning to row again.
Right.
Maybe recreationally in a river, but never of that extent. Because again, that's never what this was about. It was always about the bigger challenge. You know, can we do this? They're the first team of four to ever row across the Pacific Ocean, men or women. So they didn't break records. They set them.
Right.
And so that not they achieved the thing they wanted to achieve. So I don't know what they could do otherwise. Maybe the Indian Ocean, but I don't think they have any interest in that.
Right.
I still can't believe that you, making your documentary film, you don't have your fingerprints on it because everything is left up to them with like GoPro cameras and you would meet up with them and interview them.
Yeah, the film is really a mixture of several things. It's mostly their footage from sea, which was incredibly difficult and a huge risk. I didn't know if there would be any footage on the hard drives when I would collect them on land. So that's terrifying as a filmmaker. You can't really recreate this.
Yeah,
there were no pickups, no wild lines to get. Mm-hmm. But also I would be with them for like 7 to 10 days on land every time they stopped to restock the road. And sometimes their families couldn't even be there because we were so far away. The island of Samoa is gorgeous. Anyone should visit, but it's so far away.
Yeah.
So we would film with them for about 7 to 10 days, interviewing them at length about how the journey had gone, what they were expecting of the upcoming leg, and filling in those blanks of the story, and then also the footage from air, really. So I would go out with a drone and meet them about 12 hours offshore while they were coming in and getting all those aerial shots that you see in the trailer, which really helps bring the whole film together to remind the audience how small and insignificant this pink boat is in this massive ocean.
I want an update on a question I've asked you before. It frustrates me to no end that more women aren't directing films.
Agreed.
We've made a huge progress with the lady who directed
Patty Jenkins.
Patty Jenkins directed Wonder Woman, and it's made more money than any film a woman has ever helmed, and that's good news.
Yeah.
So what is the problem? It's 2017. Mm. Why aren't more studios saying a woman can do just as good a job as a guy can do on a movie?
You know, I hope this isn't true, but it feels like it's like any other industry. Why aren't there more female CEOs? Why aren't there more female doctors? There's so many factors. I don't think we can pinpoint one thing, but a lot of times what seems to happen in Hollywood is people want to hire people like them, right? You know, you want to be comfortable around people just like you. And if there's men at the top, then they're bringing up younger men and sort of grooming this next generation. Not true across the board, but that seems to be the problem.
I never even thought of it that way, but it's true.
If you want to have a mentee, it's probably going to be someone like you. I want to help this kid. That's what happened with Colin Trevorrow for Jurassic World. Brad Bird said, this guy who directed a lot of Pixar movies, he said, this guy reminds me of myself. I'm going to help him out. And so he directed Jurassic World, and now he's, you know, fine in his career. But there's not a female Brad Bird equivalent bringing up women. So thank goodness Patty Jenkins has made this huge impact, and hopefully we'll see the ripple effect for that for many years to come.
Have you felt that you personally have lost out on jobs because you're a woman and not a man?
That's hard to say. I mean, perhaps, but for me, I really pride myself on creating my own opportunities.
Yeah.
That's both of my feature films have been because I just had the tenacity and the perseverance to keep going. So not necessarily, but I'm sure there's been things behind the scenes I can't even, you know, understand. But you just can't think of it that way. I'm going to be a woman my whole life.
Yeah.
So I'm going to work with what I have. And I think that we bring such a unique perspective, and there's so many stories that still need to be told from women and people of color that aren't being told. So I'm happy to be on that side of history.
Good.
Just watching the women in this film, Losing Sight of Shore, working to exhaustion, not allowing themselves to fail, is really an uplifting story in itself. The screening is happening Wednesday night, 7 p.m. at the Davis Theater. You can go to losingsightofshore.com. And if we can't make it, where else can we see Losing Sight of Shore?
I am so happy to report that the film is on Netflix worldwide, as well as iTunes and Amazon. So it's been really exciting sharing the story with the world, and I hope more people watch it. It's truly evergreen.
Yeah.
Watch it anytime, anywhere, and you'll feel uplifted.
Good. We have less than a minute, but what are you working on next?
Well, I'm actually expecting, so
congratulations.
I'm developing a human.
Yeah.
Which I'm really excited.
I was like, expecting what? It didn't click all of a sudden.
Yeah, so I'm on the journey to motherhood. I'm really excited about it. And
Another project that takes nine months.
Yeah, exactly. I'll make many more films to come, but each one takes so much of your time and love and energy. It's got to be the right thing, but I'm excited for whatever it is.
Excellent. Very good.
That's your Pacific now to get
exactly.
through this and to be a good mom. Because
you said
boy,
till 18, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yep.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank
Great
you.
To see you again. It's Thank Sarah Moshman again, Losing Sight of Shore. Go to losingsightofshore.com. All your information's right there. Thanks. Great to see you.
Thanks.
We'll take a quick break. We have news next, and then Eric Zorn joins us at Spillin' Monday on WGN.
Zorn, 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 the greatest father in all the land. Zorn, 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 we sing the praises of Zorn.
We sure do.
We have to, Wendy.
It's Eric's, a contract.
It's in our contract that we must sing the praises of Eric Zorn. Fine columnist for your Chicago Tribune. Eric, nice to see you.
Good
How
to see you guys. How are you?
Fine. You wanted to talk about a story that is a very, very interesting story for several reasons. Take it away.
Well, back in 1988, in the summer of 1988, there was a huge story around here locally when this couple from Wheaton College just vanished in thin air. If you, did,
I totally remember this story.
Her
like all
car,
the newscasts.
Yes. Yeah, her car is found in the loop in an alley. The engine is running, and his wallet is in the back seat, and some clothes. And you know, it's like it looks really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out that they had been secretly married a few days earlier, and I guess they had told a few people in their family, but not both families. And it was one of these things, and they were this young, good-looking couple. And Wheaton College, as most listeners know, is a very straight-laced, conservative Christian college out in Wheaton. So there's this incredible mystery that develops, and it dominates the news. It's national news: the Washington Post, New York Times, Tribune. Everybody's doing this story. Where is this couple? What's happened to them? There's a search by air. They're searching Amtrak. They're interviewing people. They're the search goes over four states. And a lot of people really were expecting the worst, that this young couple had been victimized, taken advantage of. Obviously, the car, I think it was a BMW, it was a nice car. There was also, at that time, and I think this is still the case, there's sort of this missing white person phenomenon, right? That if they had not been this attractive young, let's be honest, a white couple, I don't think this would have been nearly the story that it was.
Mm-hmm.
But let's also point out that this story, if this story had happened in the modern era, this was before CNN, before 24/7 cable, any of that stuff, this would have been like that missing plane. I mean, they would have gone wall to wall on CNN about this case. Now, this is a story that was extremely prominent, again, for many months. And then it was about 4 months later that they had decided to just run off. And
I remember being mad at them when I found that
out.
Well,
you're mad at them because, first of all, they put their families through hell. They put their friends through hell. They put police through their
all the
paces,
resources.
All
used.
The resources. Their whole thing was they wanted to isolate themselves and find perfect love, just the two of them with nothing, just basically starting again, this almost embryonic stage of romance. And you can...
Was there an element, I'm trying to remember if one of the families didn't approve of the marriage
the little wild card element was that Scott Swanson, the husband, this is Scott and Carolyn Swanson, that Scott Swanson had a military obligation because he had an ROTC scholarship, and that part of this was they were getting away from that, they were escaping that.
Yeah.
But they had actually... It's
a good
had,
way to do it, to get
they,
out of it.
What they had done was they had left their car, I think they said they left it somewhere else, it may have been stolen once they had left it. And they had gotten on the L, and they had gone out to the airport, and they had flown under assumed names, which you can't do
now. Try that now. Yeah, impossible.
And she was blonde. She dyed her hair red, I guess cut it, and they went and they were living they were bumming it in the suburb of San Diego. They were working like sort of menial jobs. And they were living there, and they decided at some point that they couldn't. They were following the coverage of this in the library. They were looking at the newspapers. And they finally decided they couldn't do this anymore. They wrote to their parents. And
after
then,
how long?
4 months. And then the parents came out, and they actually brought the Tribune came along, just looking at our news clips, and we were able to get some good interviews with them about what this had been like for them, with the family, what it had been like. And this story just kind of disappeared. It was like the summer of '88, basically. Mm-hmm.
It was.
You remember this?
Almost
30
years ago.
It was a huge story, and. You know, and Wendy points out a lot of people were angry with them. And some people, but other people were mixed their anger. I was one of the people who was like, this is really annoying and stupid. But on the other hand, you know, just to remember being that young and that much in love that you would do something that goofy, was kind of, there's something sweet about it, or Shakespearean or something. There was something about that story really captured a lot of people's imaginations. But again, this was before we had, you know, 24/7 cable and all that. And so they kind of just disappeared. They went back into the woodwork and led apparently a normal life after that. I hadn't thought about them for years. Wendy, you remember?
No.
You know, just like, it wasn't anything that came to my mind. And then I got an email last week that the woman had died, Carolyn, had died at age 50. And
very young.
Yeah, and someone had sent me some of the online obituaries and so on. And I just, it was one of those stories that I thought, you know, this is kind of, as you read the obituaries, and I talked to a family friend, and they didn't want to give out any details of what had happened to her. But you know, they said that she and her husband, Scott, had built this life together. They said they had a great life.
They were still together.
They're still together, which frankly, if you'd asked me like 2 weeks ago out of the blue, do you think this couple's still together? I would say probably, given that kind of wacky, troubled beginning.
It's a weird way to start a relationship.
Well, she was a junior and he was a senior in college. A lot of things. I mean, it's tough enough to keep a relationship going, let alone one that gets off to a start like that. But they have two adult children that were mentioned in the obituaries.
Wow.
And it was just, you know, it was one of those things where you kind of go back and revisit that. And it was so much more innocent time as far as the media is concerned. When you think about the way we just kind of, okay, that story's over. I mean, and you think of all the stories since then, like, you know, the runaway bride and all those stories that just we fixate on,
right?
And it was
kid in the hot air balloon comes to mind right away.
Yeah,
it was nice to know. I mean, as sad as it was to know that she had died, it was nice to know that they had been able to build this life together.
Right.
They had escaped the gravitational pull of this. I don't know if scandal's the right word, but because they never faced any charges. There's no law against disappearing.
Right.
And they didn't, you know, all they did was they left, you know, so people were like, well, this is terrible, but, you know, they left.
It was terrible for the family, though. I can't imagine wondering where your kid is and not knowing for 4 months and then finding out, oh, we just wanted.
But how did they not take that, as they were planning this, how did that not become one of the things they discussed? Like, there's going to be people that miss us. How did that not come up?
Well, you know, I think when you are really crazy in love, you lose a lot of perspective.
Yeah.
And I don't think they had any idea, and this was one of the things that one of them said in the interviews with the journalist at the time, was they had no idea that people were going to care. I mean, they thought, oh, yeah, their families would miss them, like, oh, those kids, and they'd probably run off somewhere, and maybe a couple of friends at the college would wonder what happened to them. They had no idea that the New York Times, Washington Post, People magazine would be all over a story like that. So,
how would it play out differently today because of technology and because you can't just get on a plane and tell them you're somebody you're not? It'd be impossible almost to do that, right?
Yeah, I think that this would last a couple of days.
And
even if they did get on a plane with the 24/7 news out there, someone would have spotted them and called somebody. I just feel like the ruse couldn't have gone out.
There's cameras everywhere.
I mean, they went to San Diego, which is, you know, a long way away. So there were the pictures of them all over the media here. I don't think it certainly wasn't as big a story in California.
Yeah.
I'm sure it ran. But now with the way we obsess about these stories, their faces would have been everywhere. This would not have lasted more than a couple of days, I don't think. The other thing is that they got jobs without having to provide any documentation at all. They were working, and they hadn't yet, you know, filled out all the forms and given the social security numbers. I don't think that can happen. I mean, you can do, you know, day labor and things like that without providing that information. But I think now there's just the way things are. You know, there would have been cameras everywhere. First of all, there would have been cameras that would have caught, you know, the car in the loop,
right,
and the whole thing, and cameras, you know, on the L platform. So it just couldn't have possibly happened. So it was like something that we've just one of those memories, and it has a sad ending
of her dying.
But as I said in the column, you know, until death do them part. You know, they manage that.
Mr. Romantic.
Yeah, very romantic, Eric.
Softy.
Do you ever see shows? There's a couple of shows on network TV, like 48 Hours and stuff, where they tell you some mystery that's been going on in a town where people have been disappearing for 25 or 30 years, and you go, why is this the first I'm hearing about this? Like, every time I watch that show, there's some horrible thing that's been going on forever. It's not always in our neighborhood. Sometimes it's somewhere else in the country. But you go, are there that many things like this going on that could be going on forever and I didn't even know about this?
I haven't even heard of this show.
Oh, there's
yeah, a, I haven't either. What's it called?
The one that I watch the most is 48 Hours, where they show you some mystery about a guy who's got like four or five different families in different parts of the country, and people are missing, and you go, why isn't this in the news at all? Why am I only hearing about this now?
Again, I think some of this stuff has to do with... frankly, you know, these are young, attractive white people in the Wheaton College kids story, and I think if you look at a lot of the stories that we've covered, the saturation coverage, a lot of them have to do with white people.
There was one last year that I saw about this stretch of highway, and I'm sorry I don't remember what state it was, but everyone in the state knows about it. But there's a stretch of highway. They go, you don't want to take the stretch of highway because in the last 6 years, 11 people have been on the highway, and you go, oh
what?
Man, how. Why isn't this a much bigger story? Why is this being buried on a show like this?
Just don't take this. There should be
right.
like big signs up
right.
and sawhorses.
Highway.
And,
yeah, don't take it.
Do not go in this direction. So I don't know. I don't know how that happens. There are these news magazine stories that manage to unearth these stories all the time. So
awful. All right, but, Eric Zorn is here. If you want to jump in, we're 312-981-7200. It's Bill and it's Wendy on WGN. Eric Zorn is here from the Chicago Tribune. Eric, do you have any stories about Ann Coulter and major airlines?
What a story this was. This one was all over my social media feed all weekend. Yeah. It seems that Ann Coulter was flying Delta. She's been complaining about Delta on social media for years. She's still flying Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently she paid extra money to reserve an aisle seat with extra legroom. She's a tall drink of water, that Ann Coulter, wants that extra legroom and paid $30 for it. And evidently, I'm not exactly sure of all the details, but they messed up, as airlines do. They messed up and they maybe double booked the seat or something, but they made her move from her, I think it was from her aisle seat to a window seat, but whatever, it was a
big
move.
Big difference.
It was a move that, well...
I hate the window.
I don't like the window seat. I think she's got a beef. She definitely has a beef here.
Yeah.
She took it to 11, right away. She went on social media, complained about how awful Delta was. She took pictures of the people, including the flight attendant and the woman, the hapless woman who was given her seat, and put these on social media. I mean, she just made a huge stink about it, complaining about what a terrible airline Delta is. And Delta, at first, I think, agreed to refund her the $30. She paid an extra $30.
That's it?
Yeah, to book that extra that seat. Sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
But then she claimed on Twitter that it cost her like $10,000 worth of her time
no.
to find this seat and to monitor the kind of plane. And all. It was just
no,
it was
it
this
didn't.
Absurd, entitled rant that she went on.
Wouldn't you get roughly the same amount of legroom, roughly, not the exact amount, but whether you're on the aisle or the window seat?
I think
seat,
you'd get identical amount of legroom unless you stick your legs out into the aisle,
right.
which you're not supposed to do.
You're not supposed to do
it.
You trip somebody.
But first of all, the entitlement here of again, I can see raising this issue with Delta for sure. Like, hey, you know, I reserved this seat. I can see asking for your $30 back, which she got. But this turned into this. First of all, you know, she complained about it loudly enough that people on Twitter really is a
did
huge
the phrase,
backlash.
Do you know who I am, come up at some point? It did,
it
right?
It certainly seemed to, you know. And there was this thing like, boy, Ann Coulter, you know you're not well-liked when you complain to a major corporation. The corporation basically tells you to buzz off, and everyone cheers the corporation.
Right.
But the thing, you know, one thought that I had, which is that it is really true that if you've got a problem with a company, any kind of issue, the best way to address it is to go on Twitter and call them out in public. You can go online to their like customer complaint form and fill it out, and the odds are much worse that you're going to get a quick response.
Yeah,
I had a situation recently with Spot Hero. Do you familiar with that?
That's the parking place.
Parking place, and I had arranged for a spot there. And I was going to pay $10 for 3 hours down in the South Loop. And I got there, and the actual posted price was like $8, I want to say. It was cheaper. I could have just gone there. It would have been cheaper. And there wasn't a busy time of day. And so I tweeted this out there and said, come on, Spot Hero. And they quickly contacted me, and they refunded my money and apologized.
Your $2.
Yeah, no, I think they gave me $5 credit for my for all the agony that I suffered.
Sure.
Well, and it was at least $5,000 worth of my time.
At least.
I mean, so. But I mean, and the thing is that I knew that that's the way to get their attention. If you want to get a response quickly, you've got to go on social media and you call them out and you tag them or you at them or whatever the term of art is, but you make sure that they see it.
Yeah.
And they'll get back to you right away. And this has become like a consumer. Every consumer knows this.
Totally works. Too.
Yeah, it does work. And I don't think it just works for famous people like Wendy Snyder. I mean,
no.
I think and
the rest of us
and me, the greatest father that ever was born.
And all the land. Right.
The Twitter really helps, although I feel quite foolish that I found I started following this guy named Pete Zerrill. And I'm like, he really likes Totino's pizza rolls. And I fell for it and followed him. And it's Pete Zerrill, and it is Totino's site. I completely 100% fell for it, but they sent me a coupon.
What was it about him that you found so enchanting that you needed to follow
it? Just
him?
Cracked me up that somebody had a Totino's pizza roll guy as his picture, and I'm like, this guy cracks me up. Pete Zerrill. It didn't even kick in that it was Pete Zerrill.
But do you find this to be true about consumer complaints?
Oh, without a doubt. They're much more sensitive to it now because they have so much access in social media, and they want to keep their name as clean as
they can. Of course, I went back. As soon as I settled my issue with Spot Hair, I went back on social media and wrote, hey, thanks for the quick resolution to this. And
that's perfect.
And it really increased my affection for that company. So not that it was large or small to begin with, but I thought that was a stand-up way to handle
it. Oh, yeah.
But it gives people a chance to make it right. Some businesses really want the opportunity to make it right.
Oh, I think they do, yeah.
And
I think a lot of them do.
There's a way in which you should do it, though. I sometimes don't like when people really drop the bomb on what a terrible company this is. You know what I mean?
I feel weird to say this, but I think Ann Coulter had a point, right? I mean, she did. She paid for this seat. She expected to sit there, and then they came and said, "Hey, we gave it to somebody else, even though you paid for it."
But didn't she lose you at the worth $10,000?
Yes,
she lost
time.
Me pretty quickly, but not initially. She also there's a thing that came out that she had been less than sympathetic to the guy who had been dragged off the United flight. Out of O'Hare, she said that he should be deported.
Oh, so, that seems extreme.
So there was a little bit of irony there.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where you feel like when the company responds, most companies are very sensitive to these days.
Yeah.
So to have that have that access is a good thing.
It is a good thing.
So, Eric, thanks so much. We'll see you in a week.
That's it. We're done. It's already noon.
Wow.
You're going to get people complaining that you cut me off. It's so at Bill and Wendy show.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, complain away.
Let him talk.
That's
don't muzzle
why there.
Him.
I get it. Thank you, Eric.
Talk to
Have
you
a good
week.
We'll take a quick break and find out what Steve has next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.